The following program is brought to you by Podcast One. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Now here's your host, Rory O'Malley.
Hi there. Welcome to the Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. This is your host, Rory O'Malley. Today, my guest is Steven Sader, who won the Tony Award and the Grammy for a little musical called Spring Awakening. He wrote the book and the lyrics. It's truly one of the greatest scores of the last 25 years. It's so stunningly beautiful. I was lucky enough to get to see it in previews, and because they sat a lot of the audience on stage, well, not a lot, there was like seats on stage, and I think they were the cheap seats, like student rush, and I had just moved to New York. I was on the stage for Spring Awakening in previews before it opened on Broadway. Does that count as my Broadway debut? It was certainly before I was ever on a Broadway stage and getting paid. But it's a really special show. He has a book out called Alice by Heart that actually was a stage show that he created with Duncan Sheik and his team that he created Spring Awakening with. But he's written a young adult novel. It's incredible, and I have the pleasure of getting to have him here today to talk about it. So here's my conversation with Steven Sader. Hi, Steven. How are you?
I'm okay.
I am so excited you're here.
Are we talking?
We're talking.
Like people are hearing us?
Oh, I had no idea. Live. No, I can't. Okay. Well, we're starting now. We're starting.
But do I have to go closer to this or further from this? What do I do?
That's perfect.
This is good.
Yeah, we don't have to cradle it or caress.
Okay.
But being...
You're good with mics.
Yeah, you know, I'm a loud guy, and I like to be even louder.
That's right.
You know? Yeah. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Thank you for having me.
You have this wonderful... We're going to get to Spring Awakening and all that. But you have a book out now.
Oh,
called Alice by Heart. Can you tell us about this book?
I 100% will. So well, it's a book, you know, the new musical I worked on with Duncan, Alice by Heart, is really about a book. It's about how much a book can mean to you and how in these, I think, kind of dark and chaotic times, a work of imaginative literature can be transformative. Mm-hmm. Have such an impact. And at some point when we were developing the show, someone proposed to me turning it into a book. And I was like, how are you going to, like Lewis Carroll's, is, you know, like the subversive masterwork, how are we going to do it? And then I took it on. And it's been an incredibly rewarding journey. It's really a book about, you know, it's a girl, it's during the bombing of London in 1940.
Right.
And this girl is bombed out of her home, and her friend, whom she loves so much, is bombed out of his. And she finds him on the street, and she takes him down in this tube station, this makeshift shelter in this tube station. And she's convinced that if she can take him to Wonderland, what they did as children... Their way of being in love with each other, really, as kids, was to go to Wonderland together to read Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. And she thinks, and he's ailing. He has TB. He's going to die.
Right.
And she's in total denial about it. And she thinks she can take him there, and he can run there. He can breathe there. And what happens is, of course, it also becomes a real journey for her, that she has to kind of recognize what it is to leave childhood behind and what it means to lose someone you love, to love someone enough to let them go.
Right.
And I've really loved working on the book. It's been, books were my everything as a kid. Yeah. I was actually like sick a lot myself as a kid.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about that? Because you were sick. You were really sick until you were like 13 years old or something.
Yeah. Right? I really wasn't allowed out very much till like seventh grade.
That's wild.
Isn't that crazy?
Yes.
I was in and out of hospitals. I was like I have so many memories of my mother through an oxygen tent.
Wow.
And I was in hospitals, and then I would come home, and my room was all like covered with plastic. And I wrote plays. Write plays and put them on with like my cousins in the house. And then later I put them on in the backyard when I could leave the house.
Right.
But I didn't, it's not that I never could leave the house. It's that I didn't go to school very much. And when I did go to school, I went to school and came straight home.
Right.
So my sister kind of taught me. And my mother, who had left college to marry my dad, was taking a Shakespeare course. Hmm. University of Evansville. It was Evansville, Indiana.
Oh, okay.
So she would read Shakespeare to me.
Wow.
And had this huge impact on me. And then I remember getting a copy of Emily Dickinson from the library. I really think this is, I don't mean this in the wrong way. I mean it in a true way. So much of where Spring Awakening, the lyrics came from.
I mean, I didn't know this about you until I was preparing for this interview. And I was like, this man was made to write about a young person's awakening to the world. And
yeah.
like that, you know, that there's, it's a different time period, but those young people were sheltered and, and you were sheltered physically because of being sick, but books and finding out information about the world, and it had to have impacted how you
wrote
that
hugely,
show.
It's hugely impacted the show. And also the outlet of poetry,
yeah.
the outlet of expression and imagery.
Right.
You know, I had, and this is going to sound like my whole life is just hapless, but when I was 20, I was trapped in a fire. I had this horrific accident. I was on fire, and I had to leap off a third-story balcony to get out.
Oh, my God.
And I shattered and fractured like a total of 20 vertebrae. I was like laid up. And I was on this, it's like an ironing board. It's called a striker frame. It got turned every 2 hours through the night. And I had a page turner I could turn with my teeth, and both of my back and my stomach, because my arms were broken. And I taught myself ancient Greek. my drama
as
professor,
you do.
As one does, yes, his partner was the head of the classics department. He had just written the first, I don't know, in 40 years, how to read ancient Greek book, and they gave me a copy of it, and I just taught myself.
Right.
And that reading, first of all, I was not in the hospital. I was in, the Iliad. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
I was learning ancient Greek, and I read all these novels, which then led to Alice by Heart. But I also think that had I not become, as I did in the subsequent years after I, left the hospital and went back to school, and then I went to graduate school, immersed in the forms of Greek tragedy, I never would have written Spring Awakening in the way I did.
Right.
Because I discovered this different way to use songs in a show.
Yeah.
That the songs the lyrics didn't have to be forwarding the plot.
Right.
They could become like the voice of the city. I thought that youth is like a city on fire.
Huh.
And so then Greek choruses, they could go take you deeper into the story and deepen your investment in the story without furthering the plot of the story. So anyway,
That's
I think
so
that this whole checkered history I have has
Well, clearly
informed
you
everything.
Have a love of literature, of books, and that has definitely informed not just your work, but like what you choose to put your time into. Do you think,
100%.
Like, I mean, if you were trapped in your room now, or if a child is, in that situation, it's hard for me not to think that he would just have Netflix on and binge watch
his phone.
Everything or his phone.
Yeah, I at the time there was no Netflix, but what I did was hard to remember. But I banished film and TV.
You did.
I just said I'm not watching any videos. I'm not watching. Yeah, I just made this decision. But everything I had done had burned up.
Right.
And I thought, I have to create things that can last. How can I create things that can last? And so I thought, I want to look at these more ancient things that have been still with us. And
right.
So, yeah, that's what I did. I turned it off.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, I'm out here right now. This is not a great thing about me. It's just true. I'm out here in LA right now because I have multiple film and TV projects, as we do, survive.
Yeah.
And because I love them. But I am so behind. Like, my producer would hate hearing me say this, but I don't have a habit to turn on the TV.
Yeah.
And I don't watch it on my phone.
But that's not, I don't think that's a bad thing, especially if you are creating stuff in that medium or the way that you're inspired is not by watching TV, clearly. That's not your muse, And so the fact that you know that, that's just not what you need. And I think that that's what makes you such a unique voice. and what made Spring Awakening such a unique experience on stage and made such a splash. But let's go back to Alice by Heart,
okay,
because
please.
It is driven by your love of books.
It is 100%.
And it's also something that I think is really you touched on, because things are getting harder and harder to deal with in reality right now. Things are getting curiouser and curiouser.
I would agree.
So what is it, and especially because the book is about it takes place in World War II, that it's another time. Why do you think this story had to be told right now?
Because I think that we're looking for ways to reignite the sense of wonder in ourselves in all these, and that we're also displaced. It just, as we were working on the show, and you know, the show, going back, we had developed it with the National Theater of London, of Britain, so we were in London for that. And while we were there workshopping the show, a bomb went off in a tube station, you know,
oh my
a terrorist
God, yeah.
bombing, and I thought, wow, this is so where we have to set our show. It's underground, but like what happens underground today, and how, you know, this peril we're all walking past at any moment. So it felt, I guess did you ask me why I said it in London and World War II?
Why there?
It seemed, it just seems so resonant to me with these, and also just these communities of refugees around the world, and these living in these camps, and how do you survive that, and how do you, and I wanted to, you know, at a time when the value of facts is so in question, right? I wanted to assert the value also of fiction, and, you know, the deeper truth of stories, storytellings, that sometimes we overcome through the stories we love.
Right. You've written for Broadway, TV, film, a book. How do you approach writing a book? How is that different than writing the book of a stage show? And was it more of a challenge or less?
You know, in some way, it felt like a very pure me. It felt like a very, because I am kind of literary. I could just go into... You know, Kafka said a writer can never be alone enough. And that's what I felt. I just wanted to be left alone.
It must have been freeing, because there's nothing more collaborative than putting together a Broadway show. And it's beautiful and wonderful, but lots of cooks.
And as a writer of plays, which I was, am, you know, and all you want is to get into the room with people. You're working and working, and you're so alone. It's just, if I could just have actors and invite them over, and can I get this show on? As a book, I was like completely the opposite. Like, can people just leave me alone? Can I not look at my emails? Can I not? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I really loved it, and I found a deeper kind of solitude and place in myself working on it. I loved working on the book. It was a joy. And the people at Penguin were really great, too. Was involved in the design of the book. I wanted the book to have pictures, because, you know, at the beginning of Alice, she says, what is the use of a book without pictures or conversations? So I thought, I both wanted these. I first wanted an illustrated book, to be honest. But then we settled on these beautiful archival photos of, you know, the bombing
time,
of London in 1940. But then also I wanted the book to be in conversation with all these books that had meant so much to me and had helped me through hard times myself. So it's a book in conversation both with the Alice books and all these. It's full of all this British literature I love, and all these paintings that Alice could see in, you know, a 1940 girl could see. And they're all in London, all the artwork that's referenced. I'm not trying to make it seem like it's a really word book. It's just like young people can really enjoy the book.
Absolutely.
But I also thought that if, like if war... Like the subject, you know, war is hard, you know, destroys things, right? So then how do you carry culture with you? You carry culture with you through what we remember. And so I wanted my book to kind of include
Well, clearly you're a master of having very adult themes that young people can gravitate to and understand. I mean, that's what Spring Awakening is, you know, coming to terms with the realities of life and some really heavy stuff. But young people love it. And I'm one of those people. I might not be young anymore, kids, but I, when I moved to New York, it was in previews, and I got a
ticket
on stage.
Oh my god.
To see Spring Awakening.
Oh my god.
I mean, and that was that was my Broadway debut, basically. As I bought
it, Spring Awakening.
Yeah, being
on
stage.
So cool.
And I had never experienced anything like it. And to see the show from the stage, and to see what it was doing to the actual audience out there, and to be a part of it. I remember Jonathan Groff climbing the back wall of the stage, and that I can being able to see him gasp for air because his heart was completely poured into this role. You knew that it was going to change something. It was like a generational shift.
Wow.
In handing over the car keys of telling stories on a Broadway stage. And it also was at the Eugene O'Neill Theater, a theater that is very near and dear to me because that's where Book of Mormon plays now. Mm-hmm. And so it was such a important show that really made me, it spoke to me and made me feel like I have to take the reins of what I want to say on a stage. And I think that it did that for so many people, whether they're in theater or not. Mm-hmm. You gave a voice to so many people.
I think that part of what, I got asked this a lot, and like, this is a YA book, and it's like, but I, like someone was just reading it. My friend, Jesse Nelson, who's my partner on Alice by Heart, director. And she said, I didn't know you could write a YA book. She said, you have your poetry in this. You have a voice. And I thought, I remember when we, what was the record store in Times Square in the time of Spring Awakening? Was it HMV? Something?
It wasn't Tower.
No, it wasn't a Tower. There was a big record store.
Yeah.
In the era of CDs. Yeah. Do you know what I'm talking about?
It was like right there. Yeah.
And we had a CD signing there. It was like right in the heyday of Spring, like right when the album was released. And all these kids showed up with the lyrics, which, let's state it, are pretty poetic and dance. Are like, these kids showed up with like the lyrics written up their legs or on their jeans or on their arms. And I thought, people don't take, you know, kids seriously.
Yeah.
Like kids are ready for something that challenges them. And I think in the production, part of what Michael did so brilliantly was, you know, the idea was in the songs, you can be a rock star in your bedroom. You can go to and Michael really pushed those performers, particularly in the musical, to just bring out everything that had been inside them. It was explosive.
Yes, it was.
What they did.
It was incredible. It was incredible to see the work because it was so ready by that preview. Like this wasn't something I was figuring out what it was. You'd worked on it for so long. I mean, I remember hearing about, you know, Gavin Creel being involved and people who, Jose Lana, I remember hearing about it for years before. What was the process? How did you get started in that? And how did you create it over those years?
You know, it was, I remember when I first walked by our Broadway marquee and I was alone, it was at night and I was walking by and I just like happened on it. I was like leaving a show or something. And I thought, whoa, Spring Awakening, that's just the name of a book in my room.
Right.
And it was.
Yeah.
It was a book, you know, I had first read Spring Awakening. I found it in a library when I was in high school. And I, like, Hanschen's monologue was the first thing. I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. And then when I first moved to New York, I was at Princeton. So I was near New York and for graduate school. And I, when I was acting, Hanschen's monologue was my monologue, my classical monologue. And I don't know. I met Duncan in 1999, and we wrote these two songs together. And I had never aspired to be a lyricist, nor had I think he ever thought he would write a song with someone else.
Right.
And it's a story, but we ended up having this profound meeting, and then we ended up writing these two songs for a play of mine that was happening at here. And he came to see the play at here, and he really loved it. And he was really touched by it. And he had said to me a couple weeks before, we had written maybe five or six songs at this point. I'd caught the bug and I was sending him lyrics and he was enjoying it. And he had said we should do an album together, which we did, this album that came Phantom Moon. So he saw the show. I said we should do a show together. And he made this face and he said, musical theater? And I said, well, but it could be cool. And he said something to the effect of, if I do something for musical theater, I want the music to be relevant to the culture at large. Huh. And just the moment he said it, I thought of Spring Awakening. It was just a gut. I mean, I guess it does show you where I come from, that's what I'm thinking
that's
of, is this German expressionist.
Yeah,
play.
I mean, that wouldn't be what most people would think of, but when that's your wheelhouse of like pulling from those titles and all that time that you spent knowing all that literature. I mean, and it speaks even more to young people now because of the time that it was in. You know, it's like that. This is universal. This
and sadly, these issues haven't gone away.
And you're not alone. Not just in the grand scheme of things.
Yes, and what struck me was that the original play was so full of these unheard cries of young people, this longing, this yearning, and that the place that young people had found expression of, you know, and fulfillment of those same cries for generations had been rock music and pop music. So that was part of my thinking. Then what happened were the terrible shootings at Columbine. Mm. And that's what really energized us when I was like, Duncan, we have to do this. We really have to. And that's why I called Michael Mayer and he came on. Michael was on it. So coming back to your question, Michael was on it. Duncan and I had been working on it for some months, mm-hmm. which is to say I translated from the German, which weirdly enough I have in my bag today. Just coming from a meeting about Spring Awakening, so I have the German play on me. But Michael came on board and he said he thought it was super cool. And he said, you know, maybe Annie Hamburger's just, this is how far back this goes, Annie Hamburger's just taken over the La Jolla Playhouse, maybe she would commission this. And she did. And we went there, and then I think Michael invited, someone from the Roundabout was interested. It might have been Jim Carnahan, but then they got interested in the show, Todd. And so we went to Sundance. That's what happened. We went to Sundance next.
Okay.
So that was 2000. We went to Sundance. We did a ton of work on the show. I think that was where Jose did it.
Okay.
Jose Lana, I think he was at Sundance.
Because I was in Spelling Bee at the same, like right at the time that the show was opening.
At Sundance?
No. On Broadway. So that's what Jose was like. Yes. When it was an opening, you know, he was like, I worked
so
on that.
He's so brilliant. Oh, yeah. God.
Fantastic.
Then the Roundabout, that's right, Jim Carnahan from the Roundabout came to see it and told Todd about it. And we did a workshop. And we were doing this first workshop. This is like in December 2000. Mm-hmm. And Leah Michelle was in it.
Right.
And Gavin. Mm-hmm. And they were so, like, he was so tall and she was so short.
Yeah.
And she was 14.
Wow.
And Todd, at the intermission of, you know, this, like, reading, came up to me and said, I love this. What do you want? And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, then I want a full production and another workshop right away. And he said, okay, you've got it. And I told Michael, and Michael, who was very close to Todd, I didn't know Todd at all, said he never said that. And I said, he did. And he did.
And he did it.
It was. And then we were going to do it at the Roundabout. We were like on a fast track. And then we had to postpone twice for Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Oh.
Michael's schedule for that, for mounting it, and then
schedule.
The tour. And then Todd was, yeah.
He's always in demand, but that was a particularly crazy time for him because he was really like...
He was doing a lot. I mean, he was golden boy then. Yeah. He still is.
But it was just like he was really just on the scene at that time. Like
Sideman.
Yes.
So I had known him for a long time. But that was his moment. And again, it's been an extended moment, but yes. And he... So we waited. And then what happened was after 9/11 there were huge budget cuts or something happened at the Roundabout and they had to cancel a lot of shows.
Wow.
Like Assassins had been canceled, which then later they did again. But and we were homeless for several years and Tom Hulse came on board.
Yeah.
And at first just came on board like to help us, not yet to be a producer. And he talked to Lincoln Center and they agreed to do a concert. That was 2005. So all we had was this concert at Lincoln Center, and Tom got a grant and got like $25,000, and we turned it into another workshop.
Wow.
And we cast John Gallagher and Skylar Astin and Leah. Mm-hmm. And we had an amazing cast. And we did this concert. We worked on the show in earnest. And from the concert, Ira Pittleman came on board. That was And the Atlantic then agreed to do it with... You know, Irish financing too. So that's how it happened.
Wow.
And we had planned, we were going to go out of town. We had like three regional theaters, and I always wanted to go out of town because it was so risky and different. And despite all the workshops we had done, and then the Atlantic had an opening for like June of 2006, and we said, but it's like right after the Tonys, and Michael was like, no, you know, we have been in limbo with this for years. We have to say yes. And so we said yes, and then they raised money for like one last workshop, which we did at Baruch College. But it was relentless. We worked on it relentlessly. We worked on it all through Baruch College. We worked on it all through the Atlantic. We tried final song after final song. We had eight of them, like not Purple Summer, but the song before that, Those You've Known. We like went through so many different songs. And then between Off-Broadway and Broadway, you know, I've seen the Off-Broadway tape a couple times recently. And I think, wow, we've improved this so much. Hmm. Even though it was a really finite list of things, but there were things we really, you know the show pretty well.
Yeah.
So like that whole Melchior's last thing at the end, where he says, that I walk on my heart through the distant night, and I won't let them stray. That was new.
It was new.
And The Guilty Ones was new for Broadway.
Wow.
And the last thing we did was the little intro for Ilsa before Purple Summer. It was the night before we had to freeze the show, and we were doing some event at NYU, I don't know why, and Michael and I were having coffee before, and he said, you know, Stephen, you've done blah, 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 and blah, 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 and this amazing blah, blah. He said, I still don't really know what a Purple Summer is. And he said, and I said, I mean, I swear to you, it's what this our conversation was. And I said, well, it's this. He said, I know you know, and I know I understand but through osmosis through you, but I don't, in the context of especially. So we had this idea that I would write like an intro to the song. So that was the last thing we put in. And we put it in on the day, the last day we could make any changes.
Because at a certain point, a show freezes and you're not supposed to change it so that the actors can really soak it in before opening night.
Lauren Pritchard was rehearsing it at, I guess between 6 and 7. She came back from her dinner break.
Oh, my God.
Because they had to have their hour off before starting.
Yeah.
Literally. And I think she mucked up a couple of the words, like that first time. And she was so nervous. I mean, but remember, she was probably 16 that time.
Yeah, no, they were all so young. I mean, I was young, and I was like, these are kids up in this show.
They were kids,
like, they were so young. And you know, the show has affected so many people, but the careers of so many of those young people.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty amazing that, you know, Jonathan Groff and Lea Michele and
Skylar and Lily. And I mean, it's crazy. Gideon.
Yes. It is. It felt like there was a whole graduate school or college for some of them because they were so young in terms of learning how to connect to material and learning what the business is and having to kind of hold on to each other, which I think they've done really well.
Well, Lily, for example, who was 15.
Yeah.
She was like, you know, we had tutors. I mean, she was like in high school.
Yeah.
She left her high school. I mean, she was still in high school, but she would come. And then they were doing shoots for Vogue. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? It was like, and they were on billboards in Times Square. It was just like, whoa, what just happened to us?
Yeah. It's a lot. It's a lot. And I think that, and just knowing some of them, especially Jonathan, how well they've coped is so great because it's not always that way. But I think that the leadership of you guys and of Michael, you know, having to be able to kind of lead that ship and the choices that they've made have been really great because I think when you start off doing something of that quality, you know what it feels like to not just be successful but to be effective and moving someone's mind and heart. And
I think that's really incisive, Rory. I mean, Jonathan and I are close. I know you're friends too. But he used to say to me, he still says this to me, that doing Spring Awakening changed him and changed his mind and changed how he thought. I mean, he played Melchior, the thinker.
Yeah.
You know, but it, he says it. He said, your language changed my mind. And
and
I think it changed their sense, their standards in a way.
Oh, yeah.
Of what kind of work they wanted to do.
Absolutely. Well, you put everything, your heart and soul into this for so long, and then it goes on Broadway, and it's a huge, huge hit, and you win the Tony Award. What was that moment like for you? I mean, I remember watching from home. What was it like to be on that stage and accepting for music and book? And
it was out of body, but it's like, you know what I think? I think there are these moments you dream of all your life, and then when they happen as if they were in a dream. You know what I mean? Like you're a waking dream. But I'll tell you, I had an amazing moment. I had won the Tony Award for Best Book of a Musical, which was beyond thrilling.
Yeah.
Jeff Daniels gave it to me. I'm like, Stan, and I was going, so everyone got led, basically got led across the street to the press room.
Yeah.
And so we started, and it's like, oh no, the award for best score is coming up in like two awards, so just stay here and go back to your seat.
Right.
So someone led me back, it was Radio City, someone led me back into the house, and there was a production number going on. And first of all, also, like the opening of that show was a Chorus Line, and it was the first Broadway show I'd ever seen. So it was like all these, yeah, and my parents were there, and yeah. So I got left in this aisle in Radio City. And I just had this moment, like I'm holding a Tony, just like looking out on my life. I had this moment of, you know, with my parents in the house and my kids and my, it was so, I don't know, I had a moment to take it in.
Yeah.
Like it was like a moment that had the past, present, and future in it.
Yeah.
And it was transformative, but it was also like, I don't know, accepting that this had happened.
Yeah.
It was so beautiful. And then I went back to my seat and then.
And then you got him again.
I know. It was amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's a surreal thing to be in those situations. And I mean, and getting to be in at a Tony Awards, I had a hard time being present and not thinking, this must be the fake Tony Awards. They wouldn't let me into the real ones, you know? And to really kind of wake up to that. So it's so great that you were able to have that moment that you can remember.
It made such a difference
because
the rest of the night was so out of body.
Yeah.
And that moment I was present.
Yeah.
Can I tell you something about your earlier story? I never got to sit on the stage seats.
No.
Because, and everyone's like, you've got to sit on stage. Yeah. I can't stop myself from mouthing the words of the show.
Wow.
So, and I can be very conscious of it. Right. So I'm not going to mouth the words of the show. But I still do.
Well, hey, I'm sure there were a lot of like teenagers who were just singing along on stage because that was like
probably
a coveted ticket. I remember the box office guy telling me, like, well, this seat is on the stage. And I went, huh, okay. You know, not really knowing what I was getting myself into. And then that was like the seat that every kid wanted to have. I've gotten kind of myself very lucky. But I think that it says a lot that show has already had a revival.
I know.
That show means so much to so many people, and that the revival was so stunningly gorgeous. Mm. What was it like to see that and see another version of this baby of yours?
It was such a remarkable life moment. And also, it didn't begin promisingly. I had seen, you know, it was in LA.
Yes. Yeah.
And there was a production downtown, and the first production, I guess I can say that. I mean, I had a lot of issues with it.
Sure.
there were liberties taken with the text and with the score.
And it was with deaf actors, so there was people signing, and
it
so
was,
you mentioned it was. People didn't
but,
know.
And that was beautiful.
Yeah,
it was
already,
from the moment, I mean, the concept of it, I mean, we had to sign off on it. I loved the idea.
Yeah.
And I loved that he brought this history of deaf culture to it in 19th century. So it was very moving, but there was a lot that was. And I want to speak about this respectfully.
Absolutely.
So I, you know, there were things.
No, I mean,
that, you know, it was beautiful, but there were things where it just was like, wait a minute, I could shut this show down.
Yeah.
And I didn't. I reined that in, and then I gave like intensive notes.
Yeah.
And then Duncan and I came back like a week or so later. Duncan hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
And they had done a lot of the notes. A lot weren't. Michael wasn't around. Michael Arden, he was away. I don't remember where he was, but he couldn't be there. But he had you know, dispatched. He'd gotten through most of all the music notes. And so then when they wanted to bring the show to the Annenberg, I had a very serious conversation with Michael about a lot of things. And I love him, and he's like really brilliant, and his take on it was really brilliant. But I had to really be a little tough about certain things. And he understood. And we had a great dialogue. And then at that point, I was more incorporated into the conversation.
Sure.
And then from the first, we still were not part of rehearsals at all, but from the first preview, which was disastrous in the sound system at the Annenberg, but we were there, Duncan and I were there for those previews.
Right.
And then when we really had to consent for it to come to Broadway. And I was divided about it. I really thought it should go to St. Anne's or somewhere. And, but Ken Davenport was very persuasive, and there was, you know, the Nederlanders wanted it, and it was a limited run, and we said yes. And from that moment, I was really involved. So it was transformative experience in my life working with in that community with those community of actors, DJ Kurz and Def West. They're amazing.
Yeah,
and that. Those actors are amazing, and their commitment to the show, the interpreters. There was a whole team of people working so committedly and so just to the lyrics. You know, and I don't really know how to read sign language, but and I don't really know how to sign, but I was there a lot, so I started picking it up.
Sure.
And I started getting crash courses. So then at a certain point in rehearsals, I could read the signing of the lyrics. And so I would go to them. I would go to the interpreters and say, you know, this could be stronger if this were this, or I don't think this has to be so literal, or what if I change this
word?
Well,
if you picked up ancient Greek while you're upside down, then...
That's true. You can pick up sign language sitting right side up.
Yeah.
But that was really gratifying. Yeah. That was really great doing that work. And Russell Harvard, oh my God. I know I'm singling out one actor. They're all, Sandra Frank is amazing.
Yeah, they are. But
Daniel Durant, but my God.
Yeah. No, I thought it was a really fantastic production. And to be honest, you know, it's not my piece of work, but I have ownership of it. You know, like I feel like it was a part of my life experience. So I really want it to be respected. I can only imagine how... having people come in and say like, oh, I want to try it this way when they weren't in those rooms for 10 years while you're creating something and keeping it on Broadway. I can imagine that would be really difficult, but I think that conflict is like figuring out how to tell this story again to another generation. And it speaks so highly that show, which you said Duncan's goal was to be that it would be music that would speak to you know, a broad group of people, that it's not dated. It, you know, 10 years later, you know, like, you know, love that Phantom of the Opera is still going strong, but it's an 1980s power ballad, you know, you hear the 1980s, and this music is, it transcends any kind of time or place. It's just moving and gorgeous. And that it could be interpreted literally by sign language and have, you know, that speaks to the strength of your work.
Oh, thank you. You know, we were very ambitious about it when we looked at it. We, you know what we did when we first started? We went to see Porgy and Bess.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, obviously we were talked about as a rock musical, and we are, and we were grouped with other rock musicals, but those were not the musicals I ever thought of when creating the show.
Right.
If I thought of musicals, I thought of Carousel and West Side Story and Sweeney Todd and, you know, darker, more challenging material. And I think what we went for with it, you know, it wasn't only a rock music. It was like to really embrace song and music. And we had such a radical usage of the way the songs were used was so unusual to kind of voice that, almost like the subtext of the scenes.
Sure.
Came out in the songs.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Well, it's the strength of the book, sir.
Yeah.
That you can get the story across so efficiently, and the characters are so strong that we don't have to wonder while through the music where we are with the plot.
Yeah.
We can just sit there for a moment and be there with a friend, someone we know, because it's the story is told really, really well, and it's just you feel like it could have been happening today, and I think that was really important. It's a beautiful show. I love it. Obviously, I think that you are so incredible because you've done so much. You know, you're here in Los Angeles. You're taking those meetings. You got the things in the oven. You're doing. I think that it's incredible because you have such a unique voice, and I love how you use it, and I love that you're continuing to challenge yourself and do other things. A novel. Clearly, you were meant to write a book. And I'm really appreciative that you took the time to
I'm such a fan of yours, and I'm so glad you asked me.
Of course.
I really am, and it's like such a pleasure just to sit and look in your eyes and talk to you.
Right back at you. I know, especially, you know, out here in Los Angeles, which, you know, I love it here. to get to talk to theater folk, you know, mm-hmm. like it's even though we haven't sat down and talked to each other mm-hmm. before, mm-hmm. this feels very much like we're friends, you know? Yeah. And so I love that. It's why I love doing this, is getting to take the time out of a day and have a conversation with another artist who I respect and comes from the same place. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Everyone should go get Alice by Heart. It's an amazing book. So thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Rory.
That was Stephen Sader. Be sure to get his book, Alice by Heart, out now, anywhere you get books. This has been the Geffen Playhouse, Unscripted. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review to the Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, brought to you by Podcast One.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to download new episodes every month right here on Podcast One, on the Podcast One app, or on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to rate, review, and share.